Good morning. My name is Sarah, and I'll be the conference facilitator today. I would like to welcome everyone to the Prologis Q1 2010. Today's call is being recorded. All lines are currently in a listen-only mode to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you wish to ask a question during this session, simply press star one on your telephone keypad. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Melissa Marsden, Managing Director of Investor Relations and Corporate Communications with Prologis. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you, Sarah. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our first quarter 2010 conference call. By now, you should all have received an email with a link to our supplemental, and if not, the document is available on our website at prologis.com under Investor Relations. This morning, we'll hear from Walt Rakowicz, CEO, to comment on the market environment, and then Bill Sullivan, CFO, will cover results and guidance. Additionally, we are joined today by Ted Antenucci, President and Chief Investment Officer, and Chuck Sullivan, Head of Global Operations. Before we begin prepared remarks, I'd like to quickly state that this conference call will contain forward-looking statements under federal securities laws. These statements are based on current expectations, estimates, and projections about the market and the industry in which Prologis operates, as well as management's beliefs and assumptions. Forward-looking statements are not guarantees of performance, and actual operating results may be affected by a variety of factors. For a list of those factors, please refer to the forward-looking statement notice in our SEC filing. I'd also like to add that our first quarter results press release and supplemental do contain financial measures such as FFO and EBITDA that are non-GAAP measures. In accordance with Reg G, we have provided a reconciliation to those measures. And as we've done in the past, to give a broader range of investors and analysts an opportunity to ask their questions, we'll ask you to please limit your questions to one at a time. Walt, would you please begin?
Sure. Thank you, Melissa, and good morning, everyone. This morning, I'll try to keep my comments brief and talk about business fundamentals and progress towards our key focus areas with the objective of leaving more time for Q&A. Bill will have more on our financial results, balance sheet, and guidance for the remainder of 2010. Overall, I'd say that Q1 feels a bit like Q4 last year. We hear great things about the recovery, and we believe it will have a positive impact on our performance, but industrial tends to lag the overall economy, and we're not seeing it just yet. Right now, our business feels like the tale of two cities. On the one hand, the operating environment is still soft, although it feels like it has hit bottom. Our operational results for the quarter bear this out. Rental rates were down by about the same amount as in Q4, and the lease percentage in our total industrial operating portfolio was flat compared to Q4. This reflects a slightly more than expected drop in leasing within our investment management and core direct owned portfolios, offset by a better-than-expected 500-basis-point increase in the lease percentage of our completed developments. Now, on the other hand, values have risen, buyers are plentiful, and there's rising activity and optimism in the market. In addition, there's virtually no new supply, and our development business is picking up abroad very nicely. Many of our customers are talking expansion for the second half of this year. We'll see. It certainly feels like brighter days are ahead, and if history were to repeat itself, fundamentals should improve by the third or fourth quarter as inventory levels rise in accordance with a growing global economy. Overall, our FFO per share for the quarter was about a penny below our expectations. As we've said in the past, annual FFO will be significantly back-end weighted. We believe we will end the year in line with our original FFO guidance after adjusting for dilution from our bond offering. However, what's important is that we continue to stay focused and execute on three basic things, all of which we're making good progress on. First, converting our non-income producing assets into income producing assets. Second, creating value through accretive development, which helps us accomplish our first objective by monetizing land. And third, continuing to strengthen our balance sheet. Bill will have more on the third objective, so let me cover progress on the first two. The most impactful thing we can do right now is lease space in our existing portfolio. 9 months ago, leasing in our total industrial operating portfolio, which is basically everything not under development, was 87.7%. That number, of course, was significantly weighted down by our completed developments. At the end of the first quarter, total leasing in that same portfolio was 89.2%. No doubt market conditions have been challenging, but we're pleased with the progress we've made. In the future, we will reach a lease percentage in the low to mid 90% range. That will generate over $175 million in additional annual FFO, or 35 cents per share. That's real future cash flow. In addition, we are growing our development business and in turn reducing our land bank. Last year, that seemed like a daunting task. This year, it certainly seems more doable. Opportunities, particularly in international markets, are increasing. These markets are starved for new product. And while overall conditions are still soft, much of the vacancies, especially in Europe, are in older, obsolete buildings. We set a goal to start $700 to $800 million of new development this year, primarily from build-to-suits. Right now, that goal looks very achievable. In the first quarter, we signed two build-to-suits, one in the UK and one in Hungary. We also started a 1.5 million square foot development in Tokyo, which will not be complete till next year. Already we have letters of intent for over a third of the building. Total development starts for the first quarter were $252 million. As important, given where cap rates are today, we expect to generate over $60 million of NAV accretion from fourth and first quarter starts with land put into the developments at our original book basis. In addition, we signed four fee development transactions for customers totaling $81 million. Two of the buildings were in Germany, one was in France, and one was in Sweden. In one case, we sold land as a part of the overall transaction. Importantly, that land was sold at a 3% profit to our original basis. For the quarter, we sold a total of $47 million of land. So when you combine land sales with land moved into development, we were able to monetize $138 million of land in the first quarter. Now that's progress. The rest of the year is shaping up as well. Since the end of the quarter, we've signed two new build-to-suits totaling $125 million and have another seven build-to-suits in negotiations. Given the environment we've been in, it can be easy to overlook the long-term value creation potential of our development franchise. We understand that. But for us, it's one of our core competencies. In combination with strong customer relationships, our development business has great upside potential right now, especially with improving market conditions. Our goal is to unlock that value over time while monetizing our land bank and leasing our non-income producing assets. When we succeed at this, earnings and NAV growth will follow. Now let me turn it over to Bill.
Thanks, Walt. Similar to Walt, I'm going to try to keep my commentary relatively brief and just hit the key points. I'm going to cover three aspects of the company's financial position this morning. First, a summary of our Q1 results. Second, our guidance for the year with some brief insight into the things that we expect will impact the next three quarters. And lastly, some comments on our balance sheet and fund debt initiatives. We reported 1 cent per share in FFO for Q1 2010. Negatively impacting our reported results was approximately $53 million or 12 cents per share in charges associated with our bond and convert buybacks in Q1, as well as a loss on settlement of a derivative in one of our funds. After adding back these charges, we effectively generated 13 cents per share in FFO for the quarter, which was about 1 cent below our internal expectations. Of the 13 cents, 2 cents per share is gain related, and 11 cents represents core FFO. The core FFO was 1 cent below our internal expectation, principally due to the strength of the dollar versus the euro and lower expected occupancies. There were also a variety of expenses incurred in Q1 that will be non-recurring, including a one-time tax charge and increased rental expenses associated with the harsh winter. Relative to full-year FFO guidance, our original guidance for 2010 was a range of 74 to 78 cents per share. We have decided to expand the range of our guidance to 70 to 78 cents per share to take into account the dilutive effects from the debt issuance in March. The revised guidance still excludes the charge of 12 cents in the first quarter related to the buybacks and other capital markets activity. Relative to our core FFO, we are lowering our estimates to a range of 55 to 60 cents per share from our original guidance of 64 to 68 cents per share, representing a decrease of 8.5 cents per share at the midpoint of the core FFO ranges. The principal contributing factors to the decrease are approximately 3 to 4 cents dilution associated with the debt offerings, approximately 2.5 cents associated with lower capitalized costs resulting from our expectation of a lag in the timing of development cost outlays, mitigated somewhat by accretion from a delay in the timing of asset sales, the proceeds of which will ultimately be used to fund the development costs. We expect about 3 cents dilution to our original forecast from the combination of a stronger than expected dollar, lower than expected occupancy experienced in Q1, higher rental expenses in Q1, and the one-time tax charge. Finally, we will pick up a little more than 1 cent in FFO from our increased investment in Pepper, net of increased borrowing costs. Of the net decrease of 8.5 cents just outlined, we believe approximately 4 to 5 cents is of a more permanent nature, i.e., the debt offering dilution and potentially the FX, while the remainder is either one-time costs or merely a result of a lag of 1 or 2 quarters in timing. Achievement of the targeted core FFO will be dependent on seeing a recovery in occupancy in the second half of the year, as well as implementation on our development activity. From a gain perspective, we expect to generate an additional 5 to 7 cents in increased FFO from certain assets that have been targeted for sale or contribution due to increasing values, as well as gains from other opportunities that we are working on. As we have communicated since February, we expect the core FFO to be back-end loaded this year, which is driven principally by our expectation of recovering occupancies and an increase in capitalized costs associated with the ramp-up of development activity later this year. We have never guided specifically to quarterly results. However, given the disconnect between the sell-side quarterly estimates and our internal estimates, let me give a little insight. Q2 will likely see a pickup in core FFO from continued leasing and occupancy within the completed development portfolio and reduced tax expense. However, we expect Q2 and Q3 to be our low points for capitalization of costs associated with our development activity, which will mitigate a portion of the increases. We expect Q3 and 4 to show the beginning of the recovery in occupancy in the funds and direct-owned core portfolio, as well as continued occupancy pickup from the development portfolio, with capitalized costs increasing in Q4 associated with our development activity. Additionally, as most of our asset sales are now targeted to close in late Q3 or Q4, core FFO in Q4 will likely be flat to Q3 and pick up again in 2011 upon completion and occupancy within our build-to-suit pipeline. Finally, we expect little or no gain on dispositions to be realized in Q2, with our remaining targeted gains realized roughly equally in Q3 and Q4. I hope this bit of insight helps. However, I realize it's never enough. Let me turn to our balance sheet debt and fund-related debt briefly. Our balance sheet debt increased in Q1 by a little over $100 million, principally associated with our acquisition of incremental units in Pepper. As a result of our debt offerings and buyback activity, we made great progress on smoothing out debt maturities with the focus on reducing 2012 and 2013. We believe these maturities are at acceptable risk levels at this point, and therefore, while we intend to be opportunistic if the situation presents itself in 2010, we will likely put further activity on these maturities on the back burner until 2011. Finally, we do intend to continue our delevering efforts through a variety of activities. Turning to the fund debt, at March 31st, we had $738 million in remaining 2010 maturities, of which $330 million has been refinanced so far in April, and the vast majority of the remainder will be refinanced or paid off by midsummer, if not by June 30. We see no issues associated with dealing with these maturities. Let me conclude by making it clear that in 2010, we are most heavily focused on growing the NAV of the company, and near-term FFO generation may suffer a bit as a result. However, we believe the moves we have made and others that we are focused on for the rest of the year will make Prologis sustainably profitable and growth-oriented in the future. Thank you. Let me turn it back over to Walt to wrap up.
Thanks, Bill. So before I open it up for Q&A, let me just leave you with one final thought. We understand what we have to do, and we continue to make progress in doing it. It's dangerous to get too focused on where the market is today. We know we have to address today's market, but are optimistic that it will improve. Our mission in the meantime is to stay focused on our near-term objectives. They are converting non-income producing assets into income producing assets, creating NAV through accretive development, which helps accomplish the first as it relates to land, and continuing to strengthen our balance sheet. As I said before, our successful execution of these three objectives will drive substantial value in the future. We look forward to giving you an update on our progress next quarter. Thank you. Operator, we're ready to open up the lines.
Our question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question of our speakers, please press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. Your first question comes from Ross Nussbaum of UBS. Your line is now open.
Sorry, hi, good morning everyone. Here's Rob Salisbury.
Good morning.
Guys, can you talk a little bit about the dividend with respect to some of the commentary you gave on the source of the earnings as we think forward? Bill, I thought I heard you say that from a guidance perspective, there's a incremental positive of 5 to 7 cents a share now in the guidance from the drop in cap rates that's occurred over the last couple of months. And I guess I'm just trying to think about that relative to what I'll think about as income generated off of the core assets versus development gains and how that relates to the sustainability of the dividend, given the FFO and AFFO that you're expected to generate.
Okay. Hey, Ross, let me see if I can try to simplify that. From my perspective, I think we've communicated constantly over the last 12 or 15 months. We have a large portion of non-income producing assets on the balance sheet in the way of our land bank and the unleased portion in our development pipeline. And we're working hard, and we've made fabulous progress associated with that. And at the conclusion of those monetization and leasing efforts, our core FFO is going to well exceed what's necessary to fund the dividend. The gains associated with various transaction activities, from a basic REIT level, are intended to be distributed to shareholders. And so generating the AFFO through a combination of core and gains is just fine by us right now. And so as we look out, there's nothing on our radar that would adjust the dividend negatively, given the activity that we have going. And over the next 18 months or so, we believe that the core FFO in and of itself will more than amply cover the dividend.
Your next question comes from Jamie Feldman of Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Your line is now open.
Thank you very much, and good morning. I was hoping you guys could give a little bit more color on just conviction on how we will see a back half recovery. Maybe talk a little bit more about the conversations you're having with tenants, and then in terms of lead time, I mean, if you're having discussions now, how long before you actually see leases and actually see cash flow flowing through to the bottom line?
It might be a combination of us, Jamie, taking that. I think we're reasonably positive based on discussions that we've had with customers. We do survey our customers on a quarterly basis, and late last year they were telling us that they felt that they would be expanding by the second half of the year. And interestingly enough, when we talked to them again, they're pretty much saying the same thing. So we feel pretty convicted about it. The other thing that we see is, if you look at the fact that we are starting $250 million of development, and last year we started $330 million of development. I mentioned that it's almost like a tale of two cities. On one hand, in the core portfolio, it's basically flat to down slightly. On the other hand, you've got this lack of supply that's in the market, and you do have customers that are sort of snooping around and starting to sign build-to-suit type transactions. And I think that clearly, just by looking at the development and the fact that we just signed another $125 million between the end of the quarter and this sort of over the last 3 weeks, I think is a pretty good indication that there is activity. If you talk to brokerage firms, and one in particular who we talked with prior to the conference call, they'll tell you that their book overall of business is up somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 to 20%. Now, the interesting thing is that that's activity and not necessarily net absorption. But activity, 9 times out of 10, does lead to net absorption. So whoever you talk to out in the market, they're feeling a lot better. But the truth of the matter is that we tend to lag 6 months to maybe 9 months behind. First, companies create sales, and then they increase inventories, generally speaking. And so we'll see. But we are feeling a lot better about what we are seeing out there, and I don't know, Chuck or Ted, if you guys want to add to that.
Thanks, Walt. Jamie, they're also not, a year ago they were talking about potentially contracting in a variety of facilities. We're not having those conversations anymore. Additionally, when we do these surveys, we ask them what capacity that they are at in their supply chain. A year ago you would have heard that in the mid-80s. You're starting to hear that in the high 80s to 90s, and they don't ever want to go much above 93 to 94% because it creates inefficiency. So you're starting to see, that their activity level is being based upon what they anticipate, which are the sales that Walt talked about, global economy improving, and activity levels have risen over the last year.
Your next question comes from Steve Sakwa of ISI Group. Your line is now open.
Okay, thanks. I guess I just wanted to kind of go back to the pace of leasing. It looks like, at least in the direct-owned portfolio on page 1.5, things kind of tailed off pretty dramatically here in the first quarter. Can you guys just help me think about what kind of pace of activity do you need to see to really start moving the needle here on the occupancy front?
I'll take the leasing in Q1 and the direct, for example. We went back and looked at it historically, and Q1, for a variety of reasons, most of them anecdotal, always seems to be a lower quarter. And actually, we're splitting out direct and core, and if you took investment management back a few quarters in Q1, you'd find a similar trend excepting this quarter. You speak to customers, and many of them have a retail component in their supply chain, and they are not highly focused on leasing warehouse space in the fourth quarter, and that spills over into Q1. You do see some trending up of restocking both short and long term for back to school and the holidays, but that trending upward usually is a Q2 through Q4 occurrence.
You know, Steve, I would let me give you the surprise on one hand, and then I think the upside on the other hand is I'd say that, well, we weren't surprised at the drop in the investment management because, you know, we were starting from a 93.5% number, and that, you know, given market conditions, we did expect to come down, and I think we guided there, okay? What surprised us a little bit was the 30 basis point drop in the core. Candidly, what surprised us to the upside was that the development went from 62 to 67. And I would have, you know, I would have said probably more like 3 to 4%, but you know, 5% will take it. You're not going to see the cash flow coming through from that development until another, you know, couple quarters from that leasing, because you do a lease, but you know, they don't start paying your rent for another 3 to 6 months after you do the TIs and the like. So the upside is, if you look at that direct owned portfolio on page 15, it's now at 83.7. It was at 78.8. 9 months ago, you know, that's progress. Obviously, that's driven by the development. Overall, the core has stayed about the same. And so we think we've bottomed out from an occupancy perspective, generally speaking. Plus or minus, could we see it go up or down 30 basis points or so in any quarter, 40 basis points? Sure. And we saw that in the first quarter, and it disappointed us. That said, it's not completely out of line, and we believe we're bumping along the bottom. We think we are making progress overall in the development, and you know, hopefully brighter days are ahead. And we are hearing good things in the market, but we'll talk about it after it happens, as opposed to before it happens.
Your next question comes from Sloan Bolin of Goldman and Sachs. Your line is now open.
Good morning. Thank you. Walt, just a question. We heard kind of a quote yesterday on a potential banner year for private capital raising. Can you maybe comment on what you guys are seeing out there and whether that changes your perspective on your guidance for asset dispositions or even potential new fund vehicles?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sloan. There's no question that there is a lot of private capital out there today. And candidly, it sort of surprised me. I wouldn't have said 6 months ago that it would be as active as it is. We've had some discussions with some partners of ours that we've done business with globally. And there's no shortage of capital today, which is the good news. We started the year, and it's still in our plan, thinking that we would be disposing of certain assets in the U.S. Outright, and then potentially putting together a fund and or joint venture towards the end of this year. That is still in our plan, and we continue to have very, very preliminary discussions with some of our partners about it. I would tell you that I have zero concerns at this point in time that we would get that done, absolutely zero, given what we see out in the market. It's really more a question of our timing, because our timing is really needs to be lined up somewhat with our developments. And so we've signed $250 million of starts this quarter. We think we'll sign $700 to $800 this year. But, you know, you sign it, but you don't start the development and actually start spending money substantially until, you know, 5-6 months after the leases are signed. And so, you know, we are trying to think about how do we somewhat coincide those sales or that joint venture with our actual development, you know, developments in progress, and that's why it sort of pushed it back towards the end of this year in our mind. But there's absolutely no shortage of capital. The other thing I would say is I believe this time around that capital sources will gravitate more and more to operators that have co-investment. And when I say operators, I'm talking about best-in-class operators. And there isn't any question in my mind, and I don't think anybody on this phone, that we are a best-in-class operator in the industrial business. So we think that we've got a very attractive story relative to the capital. And when it comes time to raise it, we don't think there'll be an issue at all.
Your next question comes from Ki Bin Kim of Macquarie. Your line is now open.
Thanks. Just two parts, two quick questions. First, on page 1.5, did you guys change the way you guys report occupancy? Because it looks like the labels and the numbers are slightly different from last quarter. And second, if you can give an update on the marketing efforts on the Eaton Vance portfolio, and also specifically, it looks like you guys split up the portfolio from the fund 6 through 10, and you guys split up to like 6 through 8 and 8 through 10 for reporting purposes, and then what the rationale was behind that.
Okay. So, let me take the first part of that, Key. The organization on page 1.5 changed slightly, and really what it's focused on is the fact we have a core direct owned portfolio, and we have a core completed development portfolio. In our, as we've said for the better part of the last 6 or 9 months, that development, completed development portfolio is really going to become part of our core portfolio. And that becomes more so every day as we continue the lease up and complete those properties. And so this is sort of an evolving effort to have you focus on what's the leasing in the overall core wholly owned portfolio. And again, that will improve as we lease up the development side of that. But at a point, relatively soon, they merge. They become sort of one portfolio, and we'll track that. And so we wanted to just, sort of lay that out and make sure that people are focused on that, but also, for the time being, split it out so that you can continue to track the progress.
Ted, you want to hit me in advance?
Yeah, Kevin. We this Ted. We marketed on behalf of upon the Eaton Vance's request, two of the funds, and got offers in, and ultimately us and Eaton Vance were not satisfied with the offers. The portfolios were not highly occupied, and they weren't, attractive in this particular environment. People are definitely paying top dollar for, Class A assets that are 100% leased, and this portfolio at this point in time didn't meet that criteria. So we have chosen to pull those off the market. There are three other funds, and I believe Eaton Vance is interested in marketing those, and I think there'll probably be more to follow on that.
And Ki Bin, to your question, you recall in Q4 we wrote off our investments in two of those funds, so we've removed them from our numbers. If you were to put them back into the investment management portfolio, the occupancy would have declined by 57 bips. The total operating portfolio would have declined by 28 bips.
Your next question comes from Michael Bilerman of Citi. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Bill, maybe you can give a little bit more granularity on the ramp and core FFO. And I know you tried to give some of the details, but if you look at the 11 cents in core without the development gains this quarter and your guidance of 55 to 60 cents, you get to a quarterly run rate for the last three quarters of 15 to 16 cents. That's almost $75 to $100 million of annualized FFO. And I'm just trying to get a sense of what are the big things. I can't imagine that's all capitalized G&A and capitalized interest that's driving that. And so maybe you can walk us through some of the big components of really going from 11 cents, and it sounds like the second quarter is going to be more flattish, up to almost 16, 17, 18 cents by the end of the year. Just given your share count, it's a lot of dollars in FFO. And really, what changed relative to mid-March when you had your bond offering where you said you were comfortable with your core FFO guidance, and now you've decreased it pretty meaningfully, down from 60 to down to 55 to 60 cents.
Well, Michael, let me try to address it in two parts. First of all, let me touch the second part relative to the core FFO guidance. Bond offerings had a dilutive effect, and that's the biggest single piece of the decline, and that's again associated with the fact that we, at the end of the day, we've reduced our line of credit, which is our cheapest form of borrowing, as a result of those. I think we've done a great job from a risk management standpoint of pushing out maturities and basically aligning our line of credit better with what is active development portfolio. And others have gone longer in that regard, and there's a risk element associated with that. But the a couple of things that sort of popped out in March, well past the offerings, were really the winter expenses that flowed through both the fund portfolios and our core portfolios sort of gave us a little bit of a surprise there. And it's a one-time charge from our perspective. And there's a chance, we're digging into it, that some or all of that may be more recoverable than we're planning on right now. And so that's a good thing. We also took a tax charge of about $5 million that is a one-time item. And so, you know, when you start getting at that, you got about 6 cents right there. You know, so there's a variety of things that impacted our perspective relative to the overall year's guidance. But the other side of it is that we believe our development activity will, the $700 to $800 million that we've guided to, will definitely come to fruition. We're well along in that regard. However, the incurrence of those development costs will occur substantially later, and the majority of those, other than the land, will really be pushed into Q4 and into 2011, which, because of that, does increase or decrease the amount of capitalized costs associated with those, and we've mitigated some of that by planning on pushing some of the asset sales off. And so those are really the key drivers of what's impacting guidance. Relative to the ramp-up of FFO, we're, I believe, in the second quarter and certainly into the third and fourth quarter, we're going to finally start seeing the full effect of what we've leased so far versus what's occupied in the development portfolio, and that's been a painful lag for all of you and us. But we're going to start generating the FFO out of that. We're still eating the cost associated with the unoccupied portion of that development portfolio, which is a drag on earnings. If we're successful, as we hope to be, in continuing to lease up, we have sort of a supercharged FFO associated with that because we get the reimbursement of the expenses we're eating today, as well as the base rent associated with the new lease-up. And so we think that will ramp up pretty significantly through the end of the year. And then on the other side, both Walt and I touched on, you know, we need to lease space. We're planning on a recovery in the second half of the year relative to occupancies. And those, candidly, will generate FFO quicker than a sort of a development portfolio where you always have sort of that 3 to 6 month lag time for TEIs, et cetera. And so to the extent that we can get the renewals and increase occupancy in that, I think you'll see that ramp up. So again, from a quarterly perspective, you're not going to see all of it in Q2 by any means because we will get hit for some of these capitalized costs that we had in Q1, but by Q3 and Q4, you should start to see that ramp pretty significantly.
Your next question comes from Brandon Myoreny, Wells Fargo. Your line is now open.
Thanks. Good morning. I just wanted to revisit the land monetization, which you guys had in the quarter, which was good. It appeared that most of the land as it relates to development starts was from Japan, and the land as a percentage of the overall development cost was pretty high at around 35%. I'm wondering if you can just give us an outlook on how you think you'll be able to monetize land in with your North American land and your European land over the next year or two or three, and what a reasonable percentage of total development costs your land is likely to be.
Hi, Brandon. This is Ted. I'll do the best I can at addressing that. It always gets to be a challenge to try and talk about percentages of land when you're looking at it globally, because every part of the world, land is a different component. It costs more in many parts of the world than in others, and therefore is a much higher percentage in some areas and lower in other areas. Japan happens to be a market that has a very high, that land values are very, very high. The UK would fall into that category. Some markets within the U.S. would fall into that category. So I think we use on average approximately 20-25% of the for non-Japan transactions. I think we feel very good about, the activity level we have both on build-to-suits and in land sales. It's encouraging. We're very focused on getting our land bank down. The Japan deal is a great opportunity for us. So the other development deals that we've signed, I think we feel like we're definitely on the right track toward meeting our goals for this year and beyond.
And, Brandon, I would say this. I believe that it's on our website. We did a presentation a month or two ago where we laid out the fact that our goal is not to take our land to zero. Okay, our goal is to take our land to somewhere in the neighborhood to, let's say, $600 million to $1 billion. And you get there, we believe that on a run rate basis, we can develop somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.2 to $1.5 billion per year. Now, we're not going to hit that this year because it's a transition year, but I think when we finally get to a recovered economy, it's there. And so if you think about land at 25 to 30% of overall value, and you need to carry at least 2 years to 2.5 years of land, you get to those kinds of numbers. So our view is we want to take our $2.5 billion today down to, roughly the midpoint of that would be $800 million. And we think that that's about a 2.5 to 3 year process to do that. In other words, we're going to be working off excess land. Over the next 2 to 3 years, we'll probably be working off more land than we buy. We won't be buying zero, because in certain markets you may be at no land, in other markets you might have some excess land, but you're working off more land than you're buying, and ultimately you're working down to that sort of $800 million, $1 billion, whatever that number is, and then getting, at that point in time, you got land where you want it. And that should create also additional upside in our earnings, because whether or not you sell the land, which you would pay down debt or do something with the capital that would generate a return, or you put it into production at some return on invested capital, either way, you're getting a return on it and therefore monetizing it. And so that's our real goal and objective long term. And one other point, we guided this year to $350 to $400 million. Obviously, we monetized $138 million in the first quarter. We feel very, very good about hitting the $350 to $400 at this point.
Your next question comes from Michael Mueller, J.P. Morgan. Your line is now open.
Yeah, hi. Bill, I just want to go back to the comments about the run rate and the ramp up. I think you said there's about 6 cents of one-time items if you factor in the $5 million tax charge plus the winter expenses. That implies the winter expenses on a one-time basis were $20 million bucks, $25 million bucks, something like that. Is that correct? And then secondly, you keep mentioning the capitalized cost and the capitalized overhead. If we're starting with the $42 million G&A expense in the first quarter, I mean, how significant of sequential changes are we going to see to that G&A expense that will help you go from the 11 cents in Q2 up to 17 cents in Q3 or so?
I don't know. Is this an open line? Because, Michael, I'm not sure I followed the beginning of your numbers there, because the cost that we're talking about relative to the winter costs, et cetera, are nowhere near $20 million.
Okay.
In terms of sort of Q1 big picture items, there's about $5 million of taxes that are sort of one time. There's probably versus an historic run rate, an increase in interest costs, both in the funds and on the balance sheet as a result of the activities that we've undertaken. There was, interestingly enough, I mean, and I think Michael Billerman or may have said it a few minutes ago, these costs are more meaningful these days. But, I mean, as an example, we had payroll taxes in the first quarter, whether you pay the lion's share of FICA in the first quarter, and that's not a run rate going forward. And so there's a whole host of things that factor into sort of a first quarter lower FFO, and that for us, was exaggerated a little bit by some of the one-time costs, and it was offset by some benefits that we saw in the first quarter as well. But we feel pretty good about the ramp up through the rest of the year. You're not going to see a big piece of that in the second quarter because, in fact, we have, to put things in perspective, I think we have 163 buildings in our completed development portfolio, and we typically capitalize costs associated with those until they reach what we call stabilization, which is either they're 93% leased or they're completed for more than 12 months. And in the first quarter, we had 17 buildings as a subset of that in which we were still capitalizing various costs. 14 of those 17 buildings roll off into the stabilized category in Q2. And so we will see a decrease in Q2 and Q3 of capitalized costs associated with the roll-off of that, and you won't pick it up again until Q4 when we start incurring the lion's share of the costs associated with the incremental build-to-suit development, et cetera, that we've started. I think that answers the question.
Next question.
Your next question comes from Stephen Frankel of Green Street Advisors. Your line is now open.
Thank you, and good morning. I have a couple of different questions. First of all, we've seen some of your peers go out and raise equity in the public markets recently to take advantage of the recent rally, get some firepower and or delever. Can you guys update us on the ATM? I know you guys have one of those you announced recently, and your thoughts on an equity raise. Secondly, in Europe, conditions there weakened pretty materially during the quarter. We saw occupancy fall more than 100 bps for Pepper and almost 200 bps for the other fund, Pepper 2. How does that enter into your guys' calculus on starting build-to-suits, and why start build-to-suits if you have so much supply in your current high-quality portfolio in Europe?
You want me to take the first piece of that?
Well, I'll take this. I'm happy to take the second piece. So,
all right.
First of all, let me just say this, Steve. Good question. I'll take the second piece of it, and then I'll let Bill take the first. You start build-to-suits because companies want it, not because you want them to. I mean, what's happening is that companies are looking for a certain size in a certain location, 9 times out of 10 on one or two pieces of land that make sense to them. And, you might have an existing building that's out there, but the fact is that it may not fit them. If they needed 100,000 square feet and you've got 80,000 vacant, that particular building just may not fit them. Or maybe they want 100 with an additional 30 of expansion. And so what you're finding is that there are less and less of those choices, and you don't have developers building those choices on a speculative basis. And so while the market doesn't appear to be growing, per se, in terms of additional occupancy, it is certainly there are companies that are in need of space that just isn't out there. And so we've got really one of two choices. You can either ignore it, or in our case, you've got land that needs to be monetized over time. You can hop on it and do it. And there aren't that many companies out there that have the capital today to build these buildings. And so we think it's an opportunity. And again, I think you'll see, as you look at our quarterly numbers throughout the year, I think you're going to see that we will do a substantial amount of that build-to-suit business, which is indicative of the fact that the market is there. There are just people that need it. Why do it? In addition to that, frankly, the construction costs today are somewhere in the neighborhood of 20% down from where they were 2 years ago. And so you have all these people that are floating around in the market saying, well, boy, we're buying these assets at a 20% or 30% discount to replacement cost. And they're fooling themselves to a certain degree because replacement cost has changed. And now, we may be back to where it was in 2007 in a couple years, but the fact is that replacement costs are much lower today. And I would much rather build a new building pre-leased on a long-term basis with a great customer and monetize land at 20% below where I could build a building than be out there knocking our heads against everybody else in the market that and 20 other buyers that are looking to buy something that creates no value on a long-term basis. That's why we're developing today, and I think ultimately you'll find the demand is there to meet it.
Ted,
you want to add to
that? Well, Stephen, I just want to caution you. I mean, there's been a drop in occupancy in Europe, but going from 96.27 to 94.74 is, I mean, 94.74 is a phenomenal occupancy level in any circumstance. This is one of the toughest markets any of us have ever seen. I think, that's a fully occupied market at 94.74. That's not to say that might drop a little bit more, but the overall occupancy levels in our portfolio in Europe are fantastic at this point, and we have a team out there that's doing a great job keeping these buildings leased.
Bill, ATM?
Yeah, just relative to the ATM, you know, the ATM program is something we've had in place for many, many, many years, and we've used it intermittently. And so as you get near the end, and we used it in the fall, and just a tad bit in earlier this year, to the tune of about $28 million. And as you get near the end, we reload that program. We thought an opportune time to do that was when we were in the midst of following the convert offering and entering into the blackout period for the earnings, where we were in a period where we technically couldn't sell anything for about a 60-day period. Just to take the heat off the market thinking we're going to go out and sell a bunch of stock. The practical reality is that if we choose to raise equity of any size, we'll do it in an open market transaction. But the ATM offers us the opportunity that if circumstances arise where you can take advantage of something and use $50 million or $75 million here or there, that program's available to us, and I believe that, that we would use it. So the main message there is if we were going to do an offering or raise equity of any size, we'd do it through the normal process and open market.
And, Steve, I want to make one other point, too, back to the development, which I didn't make before, but I'm glad you raised the question. I made a comment in our prepared comments, that we think that between the third quarter and the fourth quarter that we've created somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 million of NAV with our land in at book basis, and that's on basically five deals if you look at our starts in Q4 and our starts in Q1. And I think the interesting thing is that we believe today that were we to sell these starts, we would create somewhere in the neighborhood of, I said $60 million, would be roughly a 20 to 21% margin on our cost with our land in at book basis. And that really is indicative of what's happened to cap rates in the last year. And so, I'd rather build it at much higher yields than be knocking our heads out there to buy it on the buy side. I think that's the way to create NAV.
Your next question comes from David Vick of Stifel Nicolaus. Your line is now open.
Good morning. It's Josh Barber here with Dave. In light of some of your comments about Europe, I was just wondering why Pepper 2 had taken such a large write-up. It was written up by almost 50% in the quarter. Was that really just cap rate compression so much in the last 3 months?
I think in PEP 2, and candidly, I think the NAV per share is the exact same number, off by a couple pennies.
It's off by euros.
And it may be the euro. If, I don't know if you said up or down, but if it moved down, it would be because of the euro exchange rate going down between Q4 and Q1. But the actual NAV per share between the fourth and first quarter, I think, is really close. So I'm not sure I understand. Why don't we take that question, if we could, offline, and we'll be happy to get back to you on it.
Your next question comes from George Auerbach of ISI. Your line is now open.
Great. Thank you. Can you provide some color on the economics of the dispositions and developments in Q1? And also, with regards to future dispositions, are you still guiding to roughly $1.4 billion in sales this year? And what kind of pricing should we expect?
Yep, George, I can. You know, it's interesting. There was $172 million or $171 million of dispositions in the first quarter. You got to back out $47 million of that was in land, which we've sort of spoken to. Of the rest of it, 95% of it was in two buildings, okay? One was the Narashino contribution to JLF in Tokyo, and that was $88 million. That was at a 5.9% cap rate. And the other one was a building that is in New Jersey, Port Reading, that we did a build-to-suit on, that we had a prearranged agreement, or an agreement with our North American fund, which we cut last year to contribute it when it was done in at an 8.25% yield. And I would say that 8.25 on new buildings today would probably be somewhere in the 7.25 to 7.5% range, worst case. And so there's value, obviously, that the fund's gotten because we had cut the deal last year. You know, the cap rate is an 8.25. But the 5.9, I think, is very characteristic of the Tokyo market today. And then when you add land to that, you come up to 95% of the $172 million.
And let me just, because we pulled out some of the data, in response to the last question, you know, the euro at March 31st for asset value purposes was at 134, it was 144 at year end. And so that difference accounts for 100% of the decline in NAV up to.
And George, one other thing. I'm sorry, I missed your second part of your question. We are still guiding. We're not changing at this point our overall disposition guidance for the year.
Your next question comes from Shane Buckner of Wells Capital Management. Your line is now open.
Yes, you mentioned earlier the NAV accretion based on current cap rates. And I was wondering if you could just talk about your internal view of where cap rates may go with a recovery. Are you making decisions about your portfolio based on an improvement in cap rates, or do you expect a recovery to lead to an increase in interest rates and cap rates stay flat? Just trying to get an idea of how you think about it as you're making decisions on your portfolio and development activity.
Shane, I don't think, and it's hard to say, obviously, but I don't know that I would be a proponent to say that cap rates are coming down from where they are today. I think cap rates are where they are, and obviously they've come down substantially in the last 12 months. And so it would be, I think it'd be crazy. Even though I think there'll be more capital in the market, I'm not sure I would believe that cap rates are coming down substantially. The flip side of that is because of the amount of capital in the market, I'm not sure that they're going up either much in the next year. And so how are we planning our portfolio around that? Well, one of the things that we talked about is that we were going to sell some assets throughout the year, predominantly in the U.S., and trade those dollars into development assets where we think we can create NAV. And I still believe today that that is the right thing to do, because there isn't as much competition to build existing buildings. We have a land bank that we need to monetize, and we've got the people in the place and customer relationships. So we're best positioned to do that. So why wouldn't you gravitate to your core competency and in doing so, sell assets that where there's a feeding frenzy, And so we continue to have that in the back of our mind. Candidly, we are less anxious to do it immediately because the developments will ramp up more towards the end of the year, and selling assets substantially in advance of the cash flow needed for those developments is significantly dilutive. And so we're going to try to time that a little bit better, but it really hasn't changed our overall view of how we go about our business right now.
I think the business model that we currently have also doesn't have, I mean, we still have NAV risk relative to cap rates, but our business model is not built around cap rates anymore. I mean, we're not building buildings to sell them, and, you know, cap rates are going to go up and down, rents are going to go up and down. You know, we're effectively, you know, going to develop properties at a return that's higher than our weighted cost of funds and play for cash flow. And we think that opportunity is out there, especially within developments on land that we own.
Operator, we have time for one more question.
Your last question comes from Ross Nussbaum. Your line is now open.
Hi, guys. Just to follow up on my first question, because I heard a couple different messages I wanted to clarify. Bill, I thought I heard you say at the beginning that you're comfortable, at least for the time being, having part of the dividend covered through development sale gains until you start generating more operating income off of the development assets. Yet at the same time, I'm hearing that the business model isn't predicated upon cap rate changes. And I guess those two statements really stand out to me in the sense that wouldn't we all feel more comfortable if the dividend were being covered simply by operating cash flows going forward and development gains weren't part of that at all?
Yeah, I think we'd all feel it. I don't think there's anybody on this phone that wouldn't feel more comfortable if the dividend were currently being covered out of pure operating cash flow. But the fact of the matter is that that until we monetize the land and lease up the vacant space, we're going to take advantage of the gains that we see out there and use that to maintain our dividend and to distribute the funds to shareholders as REITs are supposed to do. And so you're 100% right, Ross, and I hesitate to chuckle on it, but it's you're. I know the question is probably deeper, but it's an obvious answer. Yes, we would all prefer that it covered straight out of operating cash flow and core cash flow. I don't know whether you want to...
No, Ross, the only thing I'd add to that is if you've got $175 million of additional FFO and simply leasing up your development pipeline and moving up your occupancies a little bit, and that's not with regard to monetizing land and the upside associated with that, I don't think that you're really that far off at this point in time and we got no intention at this point in time of reducing the dividend. So, operator, I think we are done at this point.
Okay, I turn the call back to you. If you have any closing remarks,
not here.
Well, thank you, everybody, for participating in today's Prologis Q1 2010 conference call. You may now disconnect.